The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
About how we've come to view the world, ourselves and other people, that we might want to hold on to. Could these things tell us something about the heart of the Christian faith and ultimately prompt people to look at that more seriously? Last time I was here, we talked about largely sort of the impact of things like the impact of Christianity on things like literature and film and art and so on. And we mentioned in passing music and architecture. We looked at the growth of education, the growth of modern science as well. And then at the end we had a focus on human rights. And we looked at the work of Nicholas Walterstorff, a philosopher from Yale, who believes it's impossible to develop a secular account of human dignity that's adequate for grounding human rights. So a very interesting book by Walterstorff. We just mentioned a little bit about that. Today I just want to talk about three more things that I actually think are profound changes to life in the West brought about by Christianity. And the first of these is what I call the Great Reversal. I know you've had Professor Edwin Judge here before, speaking on a couple of topics, and I'm going to take a wild guess and say that this might be one of the topics that he spoke on, and that is humility. He's trying to think very convincingly how the story of Christianity radically altered what was previously regarded as a shameful thing and not at all a virtue, humility. In the Greco-Roman culture, there was this strong sense that the correct, the rational, the justified order of things was that poor people and people of limited ability ought to be on the bottom of the heap. That's just simply where they belong, in a rational system that made total sense to them. It was actually thought of as immoral to be concerned about people at the bottom of the heap, the poor. And in the early centuries of Christianity, one of the great criticisms by educated people was that this was an immoral thing to be concerning ourselves with. But the positive view of humility, of course, comes out of the Jewish tradition of the poor being the ones that for whom God has special concern and interest, whom God loves, in fact. And I'd argue that it was turbocharged, that idea, and blasted out into the Greco-Roman world by Christianity, which upends the established order and really challenges this honour-shame culture. In the ancient world, honour, of course, was thought of as an ethical good. It was right that I seek honour that is due to me. And you would see that as an ethical good. And for educated people, therefore, this grotesque image that you have up here on the screen, the execution of Jesus, was thought of as the worst kind of humiliation. And it couldn't possibly have anything to do with divinity. Now, as that story, though, starts to seep into the consciousness of people, the meaning of Jesus' death and resurrection becomes apparent, and therefore this humiliation takes on a profound meaning. In fact, salvation itself. The low point becomes the high point. It's an absolute, utter, revolutionary inversion of what is thought to be honourable and good. The low point becomes the high point. And of course, everyone in our culture now is of a way of thinking that dislikes someone who's proud. That is entirely, according to Edwin Judge, entirely a gift of Christianity to the West. We don't like the proud person. We honour the truly humble person. And as Edwin Judge often adds, but we hate a falsely humble person. It's because of this story. Now, we see this in the Gospels all the time. The high point becomes the low point. The disciples are always trying to be, they're jostling for each, who's going to be in the best seats in the kingdom? And Jesus says, you know, who wants to be great must become the servant of all. And guess what? Look what I'm going to do here. I'm going to show you what that looks like. and off he goes willingly to the cross. My colleague and friend John Dixon's written a book on this, Humilitas, exploring this idea, and I've just got a very short clip where we talk about what it means.
In the life of Jesus, you get two things. One, you get some teaching from Jesus about whoever wants to be great must be your slave. That's very, very strong language, and quite hard to find parallels to it in other teachings. But that probably wasn't the real impetus for the virtue of humility. It seems that his crucifixion was the catalyst, because the crucifixion was the most shameful place you could possibly be in the Roman world, and he willingly went there. So the disciples had to make a choice. Does the crucifixion mean Jesus wasn't as great as we thought, or does it mean we have to redefine greatness? And obviously they chose the latter. They said the greatest man we've ever known willingly went without his status, gave up his power for us. Then that's what greatness must mean. And so the word Theos, which meant lowly in the sense of being put low, was suddenly flipped on its head to mean a willing putting yourself low for others.
I quoted Alain de Botton last week, who wrote Religion for Atheists. I'm going to do that again, because he looks at humility. He says, among Christianity's greatest achievements has been its capacity without any use of coercion beyond the gentlest of theological arguments to persuade monarchs and magnates to kneel down and abase themselves before the statue of a carpenter and to wash the feet of peasants, street sweepers and dispatch drivers. I thought that was a lovely summary of that. Picking up on one of the many very attractive aspects of what Christianity has brought to us. And the second point of three, and not unrelated, I think these are very closely related topics, all three of them, is charity. The fact is that a world where the Christian gospel had been eradicated would be one where millions would go unfed and uncared for every day and every night. Christianity is a massive gift. Has a massive gift to the world of charity. And of course, I'd want to add that there are many, many people who have no religious connection at all, or religious faith, who are capable of enormous compassion and charity, but just where those notions of the moral good come from matter a great deal. Kindness and compassion aren't found in nature like we find butterflies and trees and so on. And there are plenty of cultures that have done very well without these as virtues. Compassion, kindness, goodness to people who are in great need. Now the early church again picks up from Judaism this notion of justice for the oppressed and gives its own slant to it of universal love and forgiveness over condemnation and those sorts of things. Now we remember, of course, at the opening of Mark's gospel, you get Jesus... first words are, the time has come, the kingdom of God is near, repent and believe the good news. The good news. And Luke has him add, the Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. He's of course talking about an Old Testament passage there that adds to bind up that beautiful term, bind up the brokenhearted, to comfort all who mourn, and so on. There's no one who wouldn't find that an attractive vision. It's a wonderful picture of life in the kingdom. And of course the Gospels record Jesus healing the sick, opposing oppressive religion, offering forgiveness, introducing truth, bestowing mercy to people. Raising the dead. This is what he said, is the kingdom has arrived in me. And his death, of course, according to those who wrote the gospel, was this breaking down of this barrier between us and God. A life-giving message. And the point is that Jesus saw the work of those who would follow him as being centrally about looking at having a heart for the needy. So looking out for those who are in need. And in fact, He talked about this as if it was the gateway to life itself. Remember from Matthew 25, when there's that imagined conversation. When did we visit the people in prison? When did we visit you and feed you? And he says, whenever you did it for the least of one of these, you did it for me. So the doorway into life itself. And so we get this great tradition within Christianity of charity or care for the poor, compassion. So we get from Emperor Julian, the apostate, complaining about the Christians. Remember this, he wrote about this. He was complaining that the Christians not only care for their own poor, but for ours as well. He was sort of complaining about this, saying we've got to do something about it. See if we can match what they're doing, because it's becoming so attractive in those early centuries, because they care not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. So from Julian to the Christian monastic hospitals for the destitute and dying at the time of Constantine. From this woman, St. Fabiola, in 399, establishing the first public hospital in Western Europe. And despite her wealth and position, going out onto the streets to seek people who needed care. To one of my favourites, John Wesley. Wesley standing in the snow at Oxford as an 80-year-old, begging for money for people, for the poor. I always think of Wesley as someone who really put his money where his mouth is. He became, of course, very wealthy through his writings during the course of his life. And he said, if you find me with more than, say, let's $5, I can't remember what the actual figure was, it'd be something like that. If you find me with $5 left on me, write on my tombstone that I was a thief and a liar. And he really lived that. He gave away all his wealth to the disappointment of his children, and really lived this out. People have followed this very seriously. The Earl of Shaftesbury, another famous and great one in the 19th century, who was responsible for the reform of factories and mental asylums, of mines and developing schools for poor children. His biographer wrote that no man has done more to lessen the extent of human misery and to add to the sum total of human happiness than him. And he did it out of a deep conviction that this is what it means to follow Christ. William Wilberforce, we all know about, and writes to modern day people like Catherine Hamlin, who left a comfortable existence on the North Shore of Sydney to work for decades in Ethiopia to bring relief to young women who are suffering childbirth injuries. And all the way to my friends Alan and Sheena Gaston from Northern Ireland, who now live in South Africa, bringing comfort to dying children in the hospitals public hospitals around Durban. Terrible stories, and they're bringing great relief. They do the same thing, out of this commitment to the idea that God is love, and that's how we should respond. Christian notions of charity and good have made a heck of a difference in our broken and divided world. There's lots of stories like that to tell, and they're worth telling. And thirdly, so that's point two. Thirdly, and I think perhaps which sort of sits over all of these things, our understanding of what it is to be a human being. We get from Genesis 1 this remarkable claim that every human being is made in the image of God. Humanity, it's easy to read, we sort of brush over that quickly. Every person made in the image of God. Humanity, therefore, is the high point of God's creation. They're given a unique place in the cosmos to be God's special representatives on earth. And when in the Christian understanding of Christ turning up, it's God turning up as fully human and fully God, you cannot get a stronger affirmation of the value of the human being than that. The strongest possible affirmation. And because of that, it came to be understood that every person, every single life is of immeasurable worth. Unrepeatable, unique, and precious. This is a really profound idea. It's a profound and orientating idea. I reckon our culture somehow still understands this to be the case. We see this all the time. People just accept, it's just thought of as self-evidently the case, that it's worth it to spend thousands of dollars in the rescue of one life. This young woman she was sailing around the world on her own. I don't know why you'd ever do that, but 16 years old, she got lost about as far from land as you can be in the middle of the Indian Ocean. No one questions the idea that we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, aircraft, ships, to rescue her. And the good news in this story was that we did find her and rescue her. Our culture lives off this legacy of Christian thinking, even if the reason for that has been forgotten, the story behind why we think that way. And of course, not every culture thinks that way. Not every culture believes that every life is precious like that, and certainly not the culture that Christianity was born into in the first century. That's a preposterous idea. It's just unfathomable that people would see that sort of value. Before Christianity, of course, there were large groups of people. Slaves, lowly born citizens, criminals, colonized people who were simply not regarded as people. They were without dignity and without a face before the law. Now, we still, of course, have our inequalities and we have our class structures and our injustices. But all the while, we have this sense that these things violate deep moral principles. And I would argue this is only because we live in the long shadow of a civilization formed by beliefs that every person, regardless of status or rank, is of inestimable worth. Ben Witherington, the New Testament scholar, calls Galatians 3:28 the Magna Carta of human freedom. There's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. So it's a revolutionary idea. But I wonder whether we see this most powerfully, this idea most powerfully, this vision of the human person, in the way that Western culture came to understand the place of those who are least able to contribute and most vulnerable to human cruelty. See, this was a world in the ancient world where children could be left and were often left outside the city on the rubbish dumps, very often females or disabled children. And it was the Christians who came along and said, no, we can't do this. These are people made in God's image. And they started to bring them in and care for them. It's a total change. And I might think of, we think of someone like Peter Singer, the Australian philosopher, who famously said that if a baby's born disabled, it makes sense to get rid of that disabled baby and try again. When the death of a disabled infant leads to the birth of an infant with better prospects of a happy life, the total amount of happiness would be greater if the disabled infant is killed. Singer restated this. I have to say, Peter Singer, there's some things he says that I agree with, but this is a pretty provocative thing. He restated this again on Q&A recently, and I would argue that Singer is entirely consistent with his worldview. His worldview is one, of course, of a closed universe. There's no room for things we can't measure and touch and so on. His worldview is there's no God or gods, and therefore there's no meaning to life other than what you can make up and create yourself. Now, I'd say that when you think that way, it at least makes sense to see people as valuable according to their ability to function well. So some form of capacity or so, or something. And this is a sort of a functional view of humanity that I think is increasingly more and more popular. It's worth contrasting with the Christian worldview that sees each person has a dignity because of them, the fact that they're made in God's image. They're made in God's image. You see, there's a great story out of the US of a family around Boston. Dick Hoyt is the father. He had a son, Rick. Rick was born profoundly disabled years ago. The family was told by the doctors, listen, he really is just a body. He's unable to function. He won't ever be able to communicate. You need to put him in a home and leave him there because it'll just be better for the family. There's nothing you can do for him. And the family said, no, we're not going to do that. They took him home. They propped him up in front of the footy. They put him in the pool and dragged him around. They got him out on the streets with the other kids and tried as much as they could to give him a normal life. When he was about 12 years old, there was a technology developed where he was able to tap out onto a computer, the first thing he could ever communicate. Never communicated a thing before that. First thing he said was, go the Bruins, the local hockey team. And the family were like, they were shocked. And they were like, this is what we thought. He knows what's going on. He can understand. Well, it turns out that Rick was a very, very capable mind trapped in a body that doesn't work. And it's a great sort of story, but we pick up the story with this, because this is how they became very well known. When he was about 15 years old, he tapped out on the computer to his dad, "Dad, there's a 5K fun run down the road, and I want you to take me in that. We've got to raise money for another kid." So his dad, who wasn't a jogger, right, I need to remind you of this, he wasn't a jogger, he says, "Right, I will take you in." So he pushes him in this 5K run, taps out at the end of that night, "I've never felt more alive. There's a 10K run up the road next week. We're going in that." I became aware of these guys when they're in the Hawaiian Ironman triathlon, where this dad, who's now about 60-something, tows his son in a boat by swimming 3.8 kilometres. He then picks him up out of the boat, brings him to a chair, and is riding the bike 180 kilometres across the lava fields of Hawaii. And then by the time he gets off that bike, it's dark. They've been going all day. And he then puts him in an adapted chair and runs a full marathon with him. It's an absolutely astonishing, beautiful picture of a father's love for his son. They've become very, very well known. They do marathons all over the world. They're very, very famous now. There's a wonderful story. And if you can see the video on YouTube and not get a tear in your eye watching that, you're a harder man than I am, a woman. It's a lovely story of care for someone in need and love for someone. And I want to argue this. I don't know this family's faith position or religious belief, but I would argue that they come to this place because of the legacy of the Christian worldview that we've all inherited and absorbed to some degree. A profound vision of what it is to be a human being. And I guess I want to contrast that with Peter Singer's vision and say, which one looks more attractive? That compared to Singer's idea of value of a person. Which one looks more attractive? Which one looks more coherent, actually? And which one can we live and what might be at the basis of it? So shrugging off Christianity, is that where we're heading? Is that the course that we want to be on? Well, we're trying to, I guess at CPX, trying to speak into a culture that we think is increasingly post-Christian. We're just trying to get people to pause and assess where we've come from and where we might be going and what the loss of Christianity might mean, in fact, for our ethics, our history, our culture, the ground on which we stand. And more positively, what it's brought to us in each of those areas. The theologian David Bentley Hart, I'll finish with this, says that whatever it is we think we mean by human equality, we're able to presume the moral weight of such a notion only because far deeper down in the historical strata of our shared Western consciousness, we retain a memory of an unanticipated moment of spiritual awakening. The proclamation of Easter. Joni Mitchell said, "You don't know what you've got till it's gone." And I'm of the mind that some of the critics of Christianity don't fully understand what it's brought to us and what we might be left with if it's finally and fully eradicated. But again, more importantly, I suppose, it's to look at what lies beneath this story, this huge story that's brought so much to us, and work out whether there's some substantial behind it and to whether or not it might in fact be true. Okay. I think there's some questions, but we'll have a moment or two, will we, Peter, to write them down?
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Got a few, some good questions here. The problem is we have like 7 minutes, don't we? 5 minutes to get through them. But these are great questions, and complex answers are required. We can't give in 30 seconds, but I'll have a go at a couple. Okay, the story about the American father's love for his son's moving, but I'm not sure that it negates the view that with profoundly disabled newly born children, it may be cruel to use artificial means to prolong life. Is it black and white? It's a good question. I'm not sure that it is black and white. I think these are ethically complex issues, so I'll acknowledge that. What I'm trying to say is and I've got a friend who has a very, very disabled child, and his life, I'd have to say, is, you know, both the father and the son, and mother, is very, very hard. I don't want to pretend that it's all easy or anything like that. But there's a vision of value of life that I think I wanted to emphasize here that might override some of our selfish concerns, more self and understandable concerns about that sort of thing, and to take us towards something more noble and dignified and wonderful. And I just think that vision is such a important one. When David Bentley Hart talks about this in his book, he calls this a profound but a fragile vision that he thinks is easily lost. There's complexities around that. But, I mean, there was even someone yesterday writing about having this terrible bone condition and has a very, very difficult life. And she said if she was screened now genetically, she'd probably be aborted. And she said, you know, I've a very difficult life, but it's a life that I love. And so, you know, you just got to set one against the other. I think there's complexities around it, but one vision of life that doesn't just... And it affects people like that, affects us later in life, this idea that who's vulnerable and whether or not you're valuable because you have an ability to do something. Once you lose that capacity or you don't, or you didn't have it in the first place, you're vulnerable to other people's decisions, I think. So there's more to say about that. There's the next question. Contemporary human resources about, you know, things like redundancy and so on. Reflect on the impact of employees' redundancy and so on. Does it have any? You know, does this sort of talk have any bearing on that sort of thing? I'd say definitely, absolutely, it does. People ought to be about, wherever possible, developing workplaces and businesses that are honouring the dignity and the worth of every person. So there's certainly work that is life denying, whereas it should not be that. It should be about a flourishing life. And so it should, especially people who hold to Christianity, it ought to matter a lot. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, it's not a simple, again, not a black and white thing where it means you can't ever make people redundant. I mean, that happens as well. But is your aim entirely, say, profit in a business, or is it something else? You're trying to develop community and relationships and that sort of stuff. So I think it has an enormous bearing on modern business practices. How are we going, Peter? We've got time for some more. Okay. Someone says here, didn't Buddha beat Jesus to it when it comes to humility? No, I don't think so. And it's a very, very different understanding of everything, really. It's fundamentally different. Where Buddhism is all about sort of a disengagement with life to deal with the very real problems and suffering and so on, the Christian vision is the reverse of that. It's an engagement with life. It's an engagement with people such that you're seeing your right place as a person before other people and before God. And so I think while there might... I'm not suggesting that this is entirely unique to Christianity, but and that Buddhism doesn't develop notions of humility, but I think the reason for it matters a lot, and how you see reality matters a lot, and I think it's a completely different scheme of understanding the world and other people. But of course, compassion... I'll make this last point, Peter, before I finish. There's another question sort of along those same lines. Am I suggesting that humility, charity and value are unique to Christianity? What about other religions? Sure, you know, totalitarianism mightn't have been big on those things, but you know, what about other areas? I'm absolutely not saying that there's no people who are compassionate and people who are humble and so on, outside of Christianity, and of course that's the case, has always been the case. I guess what I'm saying is what we have here is an understanding of humanity that is unique, and therefore a whole lot of these other things flow out of it. There were people in the ancient world who weren't Christian who valued human life, but there was it's a sort of a world view, really. It's sort of a pre-articulated understanding of what it is to be a human being that changes radically with Christianity. It's a revolutionary change, I'd argue. So yes, there are people who love their children. I hope I'm not sounding like I don't think that. But in terms of a societal valuing of individual life, there's a massive shift. And I would argue that, and certainly for the West at least, is because of the Christian story.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.